Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, March 12th. We turn our attention to Korea, North and South. Why does it matter to Hawaii? We take a look at the ties that bind us. We get an update on efforts to finalize a federal recovery grant for Maui fire survivors. Are the funds at risk with cuts from the Trump administration? Vaccine hesitancy is on the rise, fueling a deadly measles outbreak on the continent. We look at why a vaccine bill backed by the governor failed this legislative session. And history matters, but in a time of misinformation and disinformation, it's a challenge. Who gets to set the record? We talk to an author of a new children's book about Helene Hale and learn about what her life can teach us about understanding the past. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been 2 months since South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol was indicted and arrested for insurrection after he declared martial law back in December. He was released over the weekend while awaiting a hearing on his impeachment. A decision is expected soon from South Korea's Constitutional Court. This morning, we want you to meet Jean Lee. She has been watching the events unfold in recent months. The journalist and policy analyst opened the AP Korea Bureau back in 2012. It was the first and only U.S. news bureau in Pyongyang, North Korea. The East-West Center just named Lee as inaugural presidential chair. She also co-hosts a BBC podcast, Lazarus Heist, which looks at North Korean hackers. She sat down with us in our studio to talk about the recent crypto heist, which the FBI says that the North Koreans were behind. But we start with the latest on the uncertainty around the South Korean president.
I've had a long affiliation with the East-West Center. I first joined as a journalist, speaking at the International Media Conference in Seoul in 2012. So I flew from Pyongyang to speak at that conference. So I've been an alum since 2012, but then I came to Honolulu as a visiting POSCO fellow to write about North Korean hackers in 2023. And honestly, I just fell in love with the institution, with Hawaii, and I'm just so grateful to have this opportunity to really deepen my research and stay in Honolulu.
Well, you know, we were chatting with all the developments with martial law in South Korea and the president, you know, landing in jail, and they just released him this past weekend. I mean, how are you looking at this turn of events?
What a tumultuous time for us in D.C., but what a tumultuous time it's been for the last couple months for South Korea. I will say there's never a moment of rest when it comes to the Korean Peninsula, North Korea and South Korea. So I was here in Honolulu when I got the news alert that the president of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, had declared martial law. And, you know, because of the time difference, I was still awake. It was early in our day. And I had a moment of panic because, of course, when you see something like that, you immediately think, has something happened with North Korea? I mean, this is a country that is still has an unresolved conflict, the Korean War. And so anything could happen. It is a tinderbox of tensions. But watching that unfold was amazing. It's been a very tumultuous time for South Korea since then. Now, he is facing two different cases. Just to clarify, he was impeached over that martial law and is awaiting a ruling by the Constitutional Court of South Korea on whether to uphold the impeachment. Now, if they decide to uphold it, then he would be out of office and South Korea would have 60 days to elect another president. Now, if they overturn the impeachment, then he remains in office as president for another 2 years until May 2027. This has been an incredibly polarizing issue. And let me just mention the other issue, which is that he has a separate criminal case against him, accusations of leading an insurrection. Now, his release was on those charges, on a technicality. So he was released on Saturday, huge protests on Sunday, both for and against, and is awaiting the ruling on the impeachment. vote by the Constitutional Court. Now, we're expecting that to happen maybe later this week, maybe later this month. But we are seeing South Koreans bracing and preparing for that ruling. It's going to be very controversial. And the country is very split. It's a very politically polarized country. The latest polls that I saw, I think, had roughly half supporting his impeachment and less than half saying it should be overturned. So it's very divided.
Well, you know, I just know in some of the reporting on the that I've been listening to on the U.S. side, and they were saying that if he's found guilty, he could face life in prison or the death penalty. And I was just like, could that actually happen? Could they execute him?
We've never seen a president charged with insurrection like this. Let's see. I don't think that that's going to happen. But, you know, again, this is uncharted territory for South Korea. I think what I'm watching for, and of course what we're bracing for, is the protests, the demonstrations, both for and against. The police are preparing to be ready for demonstrations on the day that the court ruling is announced. We've already seen such drama. I just saw a report that on Friday, one of his supporters set himself on fire. He's in critical condition. So this is a very emotional issue. I think for South Koreans, it gets at their identity as a young democracy. It's very interesting to watch it as an American, because in some ways I think that we take our democracy for granted. The South Koreans do not. They are a young democracy with a history of authoritarianism. And so they are taking to the streets. I mean, the day of the martial law declaration, I spoke to South Koreans who got up in their pajamas, put on clothes in the middle of the night, and went down to the plaza outside the National Assembly to protest in the middle of winter. And this is a very cold country. So feeling very passionate about defending their democracy. And I think watching very closely to make sure that the rule of law is carried out. So it's very interesting to see this young democracy champion its young and hard-won democratic institutions.
There is a large Korean population here, and they do track what's going on there because people have family there. And I was amazed to learn that the street that I live on was a place where Syngman Rhee lived. And that was just fascinating, you know, for me to learn and then to dive into that history and the history of Koreans here in Hawaii.
So first president of South Korea. And just a reminder, South Korea was, you know, Korea was one country until the division in 1945 into North and South after Japanese colonial rule. And he became the first president of South Korea in 1948, an American educated, and yes, absolutely had ties to Honolulu. I can't wait to hear you tell us a little bit more and to dig a little bit deeper into that history. But that is a reminder that some very seminal events, the making of young South Korea, took place here in Honolulu, and that that heritage goes back to the early 1900s, which is when the first Koreans came as plantation workers and picture brides. So a long heritage here in Hawaii.
Well, you know, and I think, too, that Syngman Rhee was a controversial figure, and lots of drama around politics in Korea, for sure.
Yes, fascinating figure. And of course, I think that it's interesting to look at Syngman Rhee to try to understand the current South Korean president as well. So I think if we look at those figures, we can also see that tendency toward complicated figures who also feel the weight of their country's kind of existence. I would say that North Korea is the same way. This is a small country. Korea, when you look at it, it's this tiny rabbit-shaped country that is sandwiched between China, Japan. You know, there's this phrase that they use, a proverb, shrimp among whales. And that's how they have always seen themselves, as a tiny little country sandwiched among superpowers. And that if they don't assert themselves, they will disappear. Now, I think that things have changed quite a bit since the days of those proverbs, but I think it helps us understand why these leaders take on so much responsibility and are as complicated as they are. And I think looking at Syngman Rhee might help us understand a little bit about the current president. I do believe that he's fond of Syngman Rhee, as complicated and controversial as he was. But that's an interesting connection. I'm going to have to look into that as well.
You know, I know that in the headlines recently, there was a big cyber breach.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah, talk about that.
I was going to say as well, one of the things that President Yoon of South Korea, when he was explaining why he declared martial law, he said that this was to send a message to what he called anti-state, pro-North Korean legislators. And I think this is a reminder that this question of how to deal with North Korea, how to think about North Korea, is a central and very polarizing issue for South Korea. This is a country where what North Korea does has an impact. It's a national security issue that they have to deal with every single day. Now, I'm mentioning that because I think that helps provide some context around this cyber attack. So I do a lot of research on North Korean hackers, not because I'm a cybersecurity expert. I absolutely am not. But I do, as somebody who spends a lot of time looking at North Korea, chase the money trail. And the money trail over the last 10 years has turned to cyber theft. And I think it was this strategy that the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, came up with. He's a millennial. He saw which way the world was going. He saw how we're banking, living, doing everything, communicating online. And so he built a strategy that helps him get around sanctions, get around border closures, thrives in the ambiguity and the lack of regulation around cyber, and especially cryptocurrency. So it's been, I think, important to chase that, explain it, and put these hacks into context. Now, what I try to explain is that it's not just a cyber attack. And this one that took place a few weeks ago that the FBI blames on the North Korean hackers was $1.45 billion.
Yeah, not chump change. Not chump change.
Not chump change. But also, I always try to remind people that we believe that a good chunk of this goes back to supporting not only Kim Jong-un and his regime, but also their nuclear weapons program. And that acceleration of the arsenal is part of that national security threat that not only South Korea, but the entire region. And I would argue that we have to worry about that as well. I'm not sure you were here in 2018 when we had that false alert.
Yes.
With the incoming ballistic missile. But I think that that resonated because we're all aware in the back of our minds here that Hawaii is on the map. We actually saw it on one of the maps, targets on Kim Jong-un's table. And so we are within the scope of the targets of those weapons. And so it is something that all of us need to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tremendous what is happening and the instability right now of democracy. And the threats are just growing by leaps and bounds, it seems like, every day. So
yes.
It is pretty frightening.
Yeah, and I would say that the concern I have about the political instability in South Korea is that their political paralysis is happening at a time when North Korea is strengthening its alliance, its relationship with Russia, expanding its arsenal. And so this political paralysis in Seoul is happening at a time also when you've got a new administration in D.C. It's a time when they really need the leadership, the decision-making to deal with all these challenges. So it's not – that's what I'm looking at as well. Does this provide an opening or potential for North Korea to engage in more provocations at a time when there is this gap in leadership? So – yeah, it concerns me because I do think that the North Koreans waste no opportunity to get in there and change the calculation, change the equation. So this is a time, obviously, when you need to work closely. They need to work closely with their partners in the region. But we're seeing all of that up in the air with the new administration in D.C. So it's, yeah, I worry about it. We look at it, I think, from the analysis point of view, from the reporting point of view. We look at the consequences. It's hard to see firsthand, but you're going to see the ripple effect of that. So, yeah, trying to keep a close eye on it from here. In some ways, I always remind people that I am even closer to the story here than I was in D.C. And as you say, we have strong ties from trade, tourism in this place. But also, I would say that we are perfectly positioned. There is so much discussion around security, national security, global security, and defense here in Honolulu with our Indo-Pacific Command, our Pacific Fleet. Mm-hmm. And so it is in some ways the perfect place to be positioned to be looking at these issues. You know, I was really honored to MC and moderate a discussion with the Taiwan president a few months ago when he came through. So it was, for me, a reminder of the importance that Hawaii plays as a kind of, not stepping stone, but it's a place that is in the middle of the Pacific between Asia Pacific and the continent, right? Mainland U.S. And so it has been this place that has been significant to world leaders. So that was a really amazing opportunity, but reminded me as well of the perfect position that we're in at the East-West Center. So I'm happy to be here.
Well, we can tell you're going to be very busy this next year.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Jean Lee. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from journalist Jean Lee, who this month was named the inaugural presidential chair of the East-West Center. She was the AP's bureau chief in Korea and worked in policy in Washington, D.C. She dropped by our studios yesterday afternoon.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Health Insurance Assistance Program, SHIP, helping people understand Medicare. More about volunteering at hawaiiship.org or 808-586-7299.
You know that one person owns 98% of Lanai. So what's life like for the 2%? And what does the future hold for those who want to continue living in the community that they grew up in? When one person owns the land beneath most homes, roads, and businesses. That's the focus of episode 3 of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. Tune in this Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
You know, Maui County is set to receive more than $1 billion in federal recovery funds, but community members fear the funding could be revoked by the Trump administration as he tries to reduce the footprint of the federal government. So where do things stand? Here to explain is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yes, I understand that you were tracking a meeting yesterday about this very thing.
Yeah, so we're talking about the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery, and that is through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. As you said, there's $1.6 million in funding coming to Maui County directly, and, you know, that sounds like a lot of money, but the mayor was talking in last night's meeting that there's actually about $7.7 billion in damages that we're looking at from the wildfire. So in the grand scheme of things, you know, this $1.6 billion is a small drop in that ocean, but it will make a big dent, especially in housing for low and medium income families.
Yeah, well, what's all that money going to go to specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. So over half of it, if you're thinking about that pie graph in front of you, over half is for housing. So there's over $900 million going toward housing. There's also $350 million going toward infrastructure. The rest is going toward mitigation of future disasters. That's a requirement from HUD. Some is going toward public services and also going toward administration of this funding. And so, as I said, it's for low to moderate income families as defined by HUD. So that is less than 80% of an area's median income. And so for that housing bracket that we talked about, a lot of that is going towards single family home reconstruction. There will also be some going toward multifamily rental housing reconstruction, again, trying to hit that rental market. And then new housing opportunities for displaced residents who were renters in the past, and this may give them an opportunity to buy at a more affordable rate. So it's not for people who have already started the rebuilding process. It's interesting that this doesn't give folks funding directly. It actually gives you a house. And so the county will be selecting local contractors to actually build the house for these families. They stress that it's to serve the most vulnerable of our community in Lahaina first, and then it will be working its way sort of up those levels of income if there's any left over. So as you mentioned, a common question that's been coming up in community meetings is, you know, with our current federal administration, what is the backup plan if this funding might be revoked? And so Mayor Richard Bisson did address that. He said that they have asked the county council to go ahead and amend its budget and accept this entire amount this year, basically to expedite these funds. And he explains why he doesn't think these funds are at risk right now.
We're able to accept the first $81 million. And the reason that's important is that that indicates two things. One of the things it indicates is that they agree with us that the total amount should be $1.6 billion, because $81 million is 5% of that. The second part is that they agree we should be moving forward by the fact that they released the administrative amount, so 5% of it to us. Now, I should also mention is that we also have the support of the HUD staff that we're working with right now. So I think they're also encouraging us. Now, of course, if we don't move quick enough and we don't receive the funds and they decide to change, I believe we will have the right to appeal those kinds of decisions in the courts. We will have the right to appeal those decisions perhaps in Congress, because this was a congressional order. This didn't come from the administration. This came from Congress, who authorized that us among 40 other plus states that are receiving funding receive the amount we were authorized to by Congress. So I think we have other layers, in the courts or politically. But right now, our main strategy is to go ahead and accept these funds in the council.
Yeah, so we got to keep our fingers crossed that it's all going to come down and there won't be any legal challenges.
Yeah, exactly. And the county's Office of Recovery, as I mentioned, is sort of fast-tracking this as much as possible. John Smith of the Office of Recovery did talk about, you know, they're on a strict timeline from HUD. And so even though it may feel like this is moving along really quickly, there's not a whole lot of opportunities for community input, really. There's been three meetings that are happening all this week. They do want to go ahead and get that funding out to people as quickly as possible, as well as, you know, make sure that funding is allocated before any changes of decision are made on that. They're talking right now about the action plan that's been put together by the county that will be approved by April 21st, sent to HUD. They'll be reviewing the plan, and then hopefully those funds will be out and available to folks this fall. There is one last public hearing at 5:30 on Friday, this Friday, at the Cameron Center in Wailuku, and feedback can also be shared online or by email by March 26th.
Okay, all right. We just got to stay positive.
For sure. It's a big chunk that hopefully will, contribute to the community a lot.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Catherine. We've been hearing from HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. Today's Manu Minute, we'll hear the calls of seabirds whose long red tail feathers are prized for feather working. Thanks to Zeno Canto for these recordings. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Kauai ula, or red-tailed tropic birds, are one of the most striking seabirds we might see around the Hawaiian Islands. Bright white with wingspans close to 4 feet, they have two long, streaming, bright red tail feathers that set them apart from all other birds. In earlier times, these feathers were highly valued by feather workers and were used in the making of kahili that often surrounded royalty. Kauai'ula are well built for soaring above the ocean and are known to make spectacular dives from over 150 feet to catch fish and squid from near the ocean's surface. They rarely fish within sight of land and are known to follow boats to catch the flying fish that scatter as they move through the sea. Their calls have been described as a loud, sharp bark, sometimes with a piercing scream that's mostly heard around their breeding grounds. These tropic birds are found only across tropical latitudes of the Indian and Pacific Oceans. In Hawaii, they breed across all of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, as well as a few places on the main islands. After performing an impressive aerial courtship display that includes a series of backward somersaults, they lay just one egg, which is incubated and cared for by both parents. Unlike their white-tailed cousins, that mainly nest on steep cliffs, Kauai'ula usually nest on flat ground in the shade of low shrubs. This makes them very susceptible to mammalian predators like dogs and cats, which is why they rarely nest on any of the main Hawaiian islands. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, devoted to protecting endangered birds and plants on Hawaii Island. More about helping at friendsofhakalauforest.org.
An ongoing measles outbreak in Texas and New Mexico has sickened more than 250 people. One unvaccinated child has died. Vaccination rates here in Hawaii are concerning public health experts. The Department of Health says that 21% of students were not up to date on their required vaccinations last school year. House Bill 1118, introduced at the request of Governor Josh Green, aimed to limit new vaccine exemptions for school-aged children. Local lawmakers, including Representatives Garner Shimizu and Diamond Garcia, were outspoken against the measure. Garcia posted to social media last week after the bill died. Take a listen.
I just got off the House floor from third reading votes, and House Bill 1118 was recommitted. It was sent back to committee after the Democrats, the majority, realized they just did not have the support, the votes, to pass the bill through third reading on the House floor. So they sent the bill back to committee, in essence, killing it. Guys, this is a major, major victory for we the people here in Hawaii. Thousands of you, literally thousands of you, sent in testimony opposing this view. Many of you came down to the Capitol to oppose it. Hundreds and thousands of you sent emails, made phone calls, left voicemails, sent DMs on social media, spread videos to get the word out to family and friends. And because of all of that, the bill has died.
Now, the conversations, Maddie Bender spoke with Harian Lee about how we ended up in this moment. Lee is the chair of the School of Communication and Information at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and studies health communications. She says the COVID-19 pandemic was a catalyst for vaccine hesitancy.
There's a lot of different reasons why the vaccination conversation became what it is today. This anti-vaxxers and people who had vaccine hesitancy were always there. But COVID really created a situation where they somehow gotten very strong confirmation in their own mind about what they were worried about that in the past was actually true. So, you know, something happens and people can interpret it in many different ways. So many things that didn't go well during COVID-19, which there were many, there are lots of, you know, information that was not accurate. And then even some of the government sources first came out with an information and then they later and say, oops, you know, we don't really mean that. And then, you know, we had the Surgeon General coming out and saying one thing, and then the President coming out and saying different thing. We have the federal government saying one thing, the state government saying a different thing. So these anti-vaxxers, what is biggest factor that differentiate them is that they don't have much trust in authorities. So there was a bunch of different studies, but something that came out in 2022 by researchers at the University of Hawaii, actually. They did some research, you know, through a survey collected in Hawaii, and they learned that what differentiated people who are likely to get vaccinated versus who are not likely to get vaccinated was actually their trust in authorities, their trust in government. And the second factor was whether they were getting their news and information primarily through government and authoritative information sources versus getting their information through non-official sources. So people who trusted government and relied on government information sources are significantly more likely to get vaccinated. And people who said, well, I don't trust the government and I get my information mostly through non-government sources, those are the people who are likely to say, no, I don't want to get vaccinated.
Let's talk about how some of these dynamics are playing out right now here in Hawaii. This legislative session, there was a bill that recently died. So can you talk about the ways that health communications were part of this discussion?
So you're talking about the House Bill 1118, right? So what happened there? I think I've already touched upon the fact that these are folks who have very little trust in government. So you can imagine their belief is quite strong in them making decision on their own, not being told by the government what to do. So this really became more about personal freedom of decision and government not telling them what to do. So it's very important that when we, you know, work with different population, we always look at, okay, people are very different. Different groups of people have different thoughts, ideas, background, and history and motivation. So there cannot be a single message. You have to come up with messages that are tailored to fit the specific audience. So I think in this case, you know, who proposed the policy maybe didn't do a good job crafting message to assuage some of these fears among people who are against it. And another important aspect is that there can be someone who can serve as a focal point. And when misinformation or disinformation is out there, there are certain conditions that enhance the potential of those information to influence people. And one of that is having somebody to mobilize it and somebody to create a campaign to capitalize on some of these concerns that people might have. And some of this misinformation is being pushed in a way to influence people in the way that they want to influence people. So I think it was one of the representatives who became very vocal about this issue, and he really focused on that, you know, government should not tell us what to do. It should be really up to us. And then he went and mobilized people. So this whole mobilization process was quite systematic. And I think that kind of led to, you know, creating the current unfortunate situation.
There does seem to be this tension with personal freedoms and the scientific benefits of something like herd immunity, where it just doesn't work if we're all making selfish decisions, you know, for ourselves. And I looked at the recent numbers. I think for measles, for instance, it requires 95% herd immunity. And Hawaii right now, statewide, is closer to 90%. So looking at outbreaks in Texas and New Mexico, what kind of situation does that leave Hawaii in?
Yeah, no, I think, as you point out, that, you know, the idea of a herd immunity is very important. Unless we reach certain threshold, the protection of vaccine crumbles. So it's very telling that when we, you know, work in health communication and talk about these issues, how the issue gets framed has tremendous impact on how the public opinion is going to react to it. And in this particular case of the House Bill 1118, we talked about the fact that the focus did not become the notion of the safety of vaccines or how it impacts, you know, the state and whatnot. It became a matter of restricting personal freedom. So what kind of frame do you put on a story or an issue makes tremendous difference. So I think it's unfortunate that somehow that frame was put on this, and then we weren't able to bring back the frame to the right ones, which is the public health outcome, which is the safety of vaccine, which is actually what happened in the past and the history and all the scientific data to it. So that's really a failure in us in that battle of what frame is going to win out. I have a lot of concerns about the future related to all sorts of vaccines, as you point out, the measles, but you know, there was also a story about polio is now coming back, right? We thought that we eliminated the disease. And then you couple that with the recent change in federal government. They are, you know, slashing staff in health-related agencies. We have someone who is anti-vaxxer as the lead of, you know, National Health Agency. So, I mean, it's already bad enough that these people have not much trust in government and rely on untrustworthy sources of information. Now, our government might be actually spreading information that might be quite misleading. And I'm sure there will be, you know, science community as well as public health community will try to put out messages to combat this, but it's going to be very murky. And they're going to have a hard time which information to trust and which information not to. So I think this is really an important time for us to think about different ways for us to change the situation so that maybe we can alleviate some of the potential harms that is going to come forth from the current administration.
Is there anything else that you want to add, talking directly to a listener?
I would like to really tell people, be skeptical. Do not trust information that you encounter in social media. I don't care if it's coming from someone that you know very well, someone you trust. They might have gotten this information and already been misled. So do not trust information that you encounter in social media space. Always, always double check. Make sure that you double check all the information against the authoritative sources to make sure that it is actually accurate. I also want to say, do go outside of the echo chamber. I think we all have become quite comfortable living in an echo chamber surrounded by people who have similar ideas and thoughts as we are, and just trust information that's being shared in there. But all of us might be quite biased. And so, you know, it is important for you to step outside of that echo chamber, go look for some information, listen to people who hold quite different views than you, and then be open-minded about that and be critical about, you know, what's going on in your circle of people. And then I also want to say that do care about these issues. A lot of research data shows that people process information in quite different way for issues that they personally care about and think that's personally relevant versus issue that they kind of like, oh, this doesn't really relate to me. So people tend to have more motivation to process information more carefully and thoughtfully if they care about it. So in a way, making yourself to care about these important issues that's facing us, even if it might not directly impact you right away, I think that might be a good way to somehow make yourself become more thoughtful and considerate and more rational.
That was Harian Lee, chair of the UH School of Communications and Information, who was talking to HBR's Maddie Bender. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post national education writer Laura Meckler joins us to discuss how the administration's calls to dismantle the Department of Education could reshape America's education landscape, impacting schools, colleges, and universities nationwide. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Longtime educator and author Barbara Hillier has a new children's book out that examines the life of Helene Hale, a fixture in Hawaii politics for a half a century. Hillier made an unexpected discovery about her own connection to Hale that eventually led her to write the book. She talked to The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about what Hale's life can teach us about civic engagement and how understanding history can help us navigate these fast-changing times. Hillier begins by reading a few lines from the book that introduce readers to Hale.
Helene Hale settled on the island of Hawaii in 1947. As a black woman at that time, she could not find a suitable job on the U.S. mainland due to racial prejudice. She began her career in Kona as a teacher and then entered politics. In 1963, she became the first woman to serve in a leadership position since Queen Liliuokalani 70 years earlier. Helene continued to serve in leadership positions for over 50 years. So she began her political career in 1954, and she ended it by leaving the House of Representatives in 2006 when she was 86 years old.
A long, long life of service. And you made a very personal discovery about Hale a decade after the death of your own father. What did you learn about your own relationship to Hale?
Yes. Uniquely, I did not grow up knowing her. Although she's my blood-related aunt, I didn't grow up knowing her. I was raised in Seattle by her brother, who was passing as white. And I didn't know anything about his family. We had a very close connection, my dad and me and my brothers and sisters and my mom, but we didn't know anything about my father's family. And 10 years after he died, I learned that he had a sister who lived in Hawaii, and that made me want to come meet her because I then knew that she was African-American, and I couldn't figure out, like, how does this work? And so I came to meet her in 1988, and then she told me the story of how her family had split across racial lines back in the 40s, and she had come to Hawaii to live an authentic life, and my father had decided to pass as white and live in Seattle.
How much did that personal interaction you have with her play into what you were able to do with this book?
Everything. Everything about it. You know, when I came to meet her, I didn't know anything. I just was on my own journey of like, who's my dad's family and who are these people? So I didn't set out to write a book or books. I set out to just answer my own questions. And when I met her, I was first of all stunned by how similar we were, just in our attitudes and our mannerisms. And it was just absolutely clear that we were blood relatives. And then our politics aligned and our interests aligned. And my book is a book for kids, you know, for future leaders. And I would hope that someday somebody would write a more comprehensive political history of the time period that she lived through, because there's a lot more documentation there than what I was able to use.
She did a lot of things over the course of her life, but so much of her work exemplified the importance of civic engagement. What does Helene help teach us about civic engagement?
Her belief in leadership and her community and what you owe is profound throughout her whole life. And she says, it's what you owe for the privilege of living in a democracy. And sadly, I would say we're seeing the results of that now. People aren't living up to the obligations that are incumbent upon them for the privilege of living in a democracy. And we might lose it because of that.
Say a little bit more about that. What do you see around you that gives you that feeling, that signals to you that sort of lack of civic engagement?
Because our social fabric is becoming unraveled, people don't belong to churches or community groups or whatever civic groups there could be. We're so individualized. We don't go to movie theaters. We don't go to do things publicly with other people. Therefore, we're getting pulled apart and we don't have the opportunity to realize that we need to have, we can disagree with people, but we need to be able to have a civil dialogue in disagreeing with people.
You know, I've spoken to a few people recently on this show who have talked about a generational shift when it comes to trust in institutions, whether they're governmental or religious. And I wonder if what you're talking about here in terms of what Hale exemplified, personal involvement, understanding personal stakes even, is a roadmap to empowering people to break through that cynicism. Do you see it that way?
I absolutely see it that way. And I think that it's part and parcel. Because people don't belong, they don't know, therefore they don't trust. Whereas if you talk to those people, if you talk to your local school board or you talk to your local government official, then you have a relationship with them, then you can build trust. But because we're so compartmentalized, we're not volunteering, we're not connecting with them, writing them letters, going to community meetings, and then we're getting our information from somebody far away. We've had a loss of local newspapers and local press and that kind of connectedness. So you can't trust what you don't know. But if you know her, I mean, in her day, she fielded phone calls all the time from people, and people would know her. So if you don't know them, you can't trust them. And I think that's what we've got to do. We've got to build back trust. I really believe, like, I don't think Americans know, and I don't even mean young people. I mean, look at all the people over 50. I don't think they know what the government does. That's why, like right now, when all these things are shutting down and now people are saying, oh my gosh, I don't want to lose that. Well, that's what the government does. But when you say the government, I don't think they realize there's local government, there's state government, there's federal government. You know, we've lost the sophistication of understanding what this is.
History is the context that allows us to understand our civic engagement. I want to tap into history a little bit more. I know the University of Hawaii recently changed its basic history requirements for students. You taught history for many years, both on the continent and here in Hawaii. You also have a master's in curriculum and instructional leadership. Broadly speaking, what are the dangers of reducing how much time we dedicate to studying and understanding history?
I would say all along, even way up to now, going back decades, we have not done a good job of teaching history in the United States. In high school, it used to be 2 years of U.S. history and a term of world history. You know, it's all this chest beating of we're so great and we did all this. And that's not a good way to live in the world, to give people a really broad understanding of what is the world and who are we in the world. And you're seeing now that citizens have a very poor understanding of that. And so our way of teaching history has not been good overall. We have told white man's history. We've told, and that's why now people call that revisionist history, when you want to go in and tell the story of the labor movements and the violence and what happened to women and black people and native people. It's trying to put the whole story together. And if that's revising it, what you're doing is you're making it whole. You're making it inclusive. But now we're going through another backlash where we're going to go back and keep telling those stories that are really more myths. They're repeated myths, and we repeat things over and over, and we don't broaden it. You can't believe you can do something unless you see somebody who looks like you doing it, whether you're a female or whether you're gay or whether you're black or whatever you are, old or whatever you are. When you can see somebody who's doing what you want to do, then you know it's possible for you to do that. And it seems like that would be a better outcome, to allow more participation from more people, but that's not the period that we're in now. We're in a distinctly different period where the very coordinated efforts are to shut down those stories, do not allow those stories to be told, make a narrative that is not true, but that advances the welfare of certain people over others.
That's a great point. I mean, we can take real-time examples, right? Because you were speaking earlier about different versions of history, and some of those get, you know, written over time, let's say over years and decades. But in this age of misinformation and disinformation, it happens so fast, it can be hard to reckon with. Good examples. One day after the attacks on the Capitol, January 6, 2021, scores of newspapers across the country and leaders in both political parties uniformly condemned the attack on the Capitol. Yet now we have a president who pardoned those who were prosecuted for the attack, speaking of them as patriots. Another real-time example, rewriting Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. It can feel dizzying. As someone who's spent her life thinking about history, what advice do you have for those of us who are trying to navigate times like this?
It's a sign of the fragmentation and the lack of trust. There's too many podcasters. There's too many people who are just yammering, and we don't have that solid foundation that you need in history. Like, what's your source? You know, where do you get that? How do you know that? We've lost our ability for critical thinking and anchoring it to some standards. Now you can just say it and people believe it and they pass it on. So that again goes back to what we individually can do. You know, we have to stop passing things on if we don't know where they came from. And we have to stop our almost, I want to say, like a crow, you know, like crows are interested in the next shiny thing. We have to focus our attention where it matters. And again, I would say, and I think Helene would say, locally. Locally is where it matters. And rather than just be frustrated and coming apart at the seams, which we are, we need to focus, like put that energy into doing something, join something, work with other people who are working on something, knock on your neighbor's doors, you know, whatever you have to do to start to rebuild the fabric. I think we've become observers in the process of our lives. And I would really encourage people, get back into being the actor in your own life.
That was Barbara Hillier talking with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson. Her new book, Helene Hale, Leading with Aloha, includes curriculum materials that can be used to help educators bring Hale's story to students. Hillier will be discussing the book at the Hilo Public Library on March 25th at 5 p.m. Look for links on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. We have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to mark two anniversaries, 5 years since COVID was declared a pandemic, and a year of an important milestone at defueling of tanks at Red Hill. On Friday, we'll be talking about all things related to the economy. How are tariffs relating your industry? Got a question for our panel of experts? Leave us a voicemail on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by going to our website or searching for The Conversation on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.